welcome to Center Maryland's The Lobby. I'm here with one of my all-time favorite Marylanders, Raymond Glendenning. He owns a company called Scarlet Oak Strategies, located right there on right off of Main Street in Annapolis, the state capital of Maryland, and also somebody who knows more about what it takes to be a governor of Maryland than I think just about anybody. He's seen his father go through it, and then he counseled, you know, dozens of governors as a lead, sort of master of democratic governors for a number of years before going out and forming this company. So I just want to welcome to the lobby one of our favorites, Raymond Glendenning. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Damian. That's high praise, number one, coming from you, and the fact that there's been a lot of gubernatorial political talent in this state, particularly in the last 15 years, coming out of Baltimore and Prince George's County as well. So I know I'm in a fraternity of a lot of quality, and I'm at the bottom of that bucket, but appreciate the nice words on the beginning.
Now, did I get it right about your role with the governors of with the Democratic governors? Can you talk a little bit about your experience there? Because I think it's fundamental for our listeners to understand that while we have so much experience with Maryland governors, there are national dynamics or dynamics that happen in every state that, you know, we don't pick up on, but people in the national sphere that are working with a number of different governors really can understand, you know, things like climate and when I say climate, you know, electoral climate and things of those matters. So I'd love to hear if I got that straight and how that experience sort of.
I started working on various gubernatorial races in the early 2000s. I was a political action representative for AFSCME's National Political Department. And for those that have worked in the organized labor, the political departments of organized labor know that despite my being there, AFSCME had one of the strongest and shrewdest crop of political operatives to kind of come out of there over the years under Larry Scanlon's tutelage, who came out of CSEA up in New York State labor politics. I got to learn under Larry, and I said, what am I going to do when I got there? I was pretty much fresh out of college and an internship at the AFL-CIO, and he said, you're going to go learn how to do governor's races. So my very first one, I did Jim Doyle's race in Wisconsin in 2002, somebody who ended up, I think at the end of his final term was there for a total of 12 years. So I kind of cut my teeth out there on that race, did a few non-gubernatorial races, but then right in a row, 2005, worked for Governor Corzine on his reelect against then an up-and-comer, the U.S. attorney named Chris Christie. Race that we ultimately lost, but at this point,
you know, we say about Chris Christie, right? I always say that he was student body president at the University of Delaware, and I had the chance to play the same role. So I always say I had to follow Chris Christie's disaster.
Yeah, there's many sayings that go around on Governor Christie. But I worked on that race, learned Jersey politics to some extent, which, as you well know, is pretty rough and tumble in its own right, and went directly.
Would you say Maryland, New Jersey, and Louisiana are pretty special states to run? Or would you even put Maryland in there, or Jersey and Louisiana just something special?
I think in many respects, particularly when it comes to politics, Louisiana is kind of like up on its own platitude up there. Both Jersey and New York are very unique, having worked in both of those states, both in terms of legislative battles as well as electoral battles. But, you know, Maryland doesn't get enough credit, and you're somebody who knows this intimately. This is a pretty complex political state, and it's rich in political history, both for better and for worse. We've had a lot of hard-fought governor's races in this state. I think that, you know, traditionally at a national level, people just think of this as a, you know, kind of tried and true blue state, whereas we know that may be true at the federal level. At the state level, it's a whole different ballgame. And I think that's part of the reason that I got so attracted to governor's races in the first place is, you know, they're somewhat insulated from the federal climate. You know, you can go into, be a Republican and go in, into a state like New York or like Massachusetts or like Maryland that we've seen time and time again and win a race and be reelected and be overwhelmingly popular, just like our current governor in Maryland is now, still, you know, hovering somewhere between mid-60s and high-60s in approval. And so I think because of that, from a strategist lens, you really have to learn how to unpack a race strictly within, you know, kind of the parameters that you're existing, both the timeline, the issues that are happening, all of the little idiosyncrasies that are distinct among the candidates and the staff and whatever's happening in the state at that point. Whereas, you know, you and I both know there's a lot of strategy that goes into federal races, but they're largely kind of dictated about what is the broader, you know, appetite among voters that sweeps across the country. Sure, there's people that get that win and lose based on the quality or lack thereof of their own races. But I think for the most part, you know, you're kind of rolled up into this federal climate where it's a Democratic election or it's a Republican election or it's a status quo election or it's a change election. Whereas, you know, we know here in Maryland and in other states, you know, it's really distinct. So I feel very lucky to have the benefit of working on so many races, working for Governor Strickland in Ohio, and then spent several years working for Governor Richardson out in New Mexico, which was the last race I did, and I gubernatorial race.
A little Roshan Patel out there for that. You get
it was a really, really, really strong staff there, including I was hired as the number two in the field department by Dan Senna. And Dan obviously went on to work for Governor Richardson and then work at my alma mater, Democratic Governors Association. And of course, was running the DCCC political department in 2018 when we were able to overtake the House. So Dan was on that race. There was a few really, really strong fundraisers on that race. There was great state staff in Iowa and New Hampshire and around. Unfortunately, we got rolled by a little known candidate that was politically weak-kneed and had no ambition named Barack Obama. And, you know, it was great working for Governor Richardson. Enjoyed my time.
Seems like it would be a lot of fun to work with him. He just gives out that vibe.
He may, true or false, he may or may not have had me read him his political briefings when he came to New Hampshire when he was showering after his walk on the treadmill every morning. Sadly, the answer to that is true. But, you know, he was a great guy. He was a great guy, and he was a lot of fun, you know, when the clock was off.
Is it true, and you may not be able to confirm, but I heard that, like, one his media person was also his makeup person, and that worked out great. I thought that was clever. I think I need that in my life. You know, I need a media person and a makeup person.
There's a lot of us wearing many utility hats for Governor Richardson. I was driving home from Manchester, New Hampshire, after he got out of the race in New Hampshire, and I got a phone call from our mutual friend Nathan Daschle, who was running the Democratic Governors Association, said, you know, we have a spot here. Do you want to come? And I came and I met with him and the political director the next day. And then I was in it for the 2008 cycle.
That don't know, Nathan Daschle is currently the most important man in Washington because he has a relationship with a certain U.S. senator out of the state of West Virginia that he served when he was chairman of the Democratic Governors. He was his right-hand man. And I would say Nathan Daschle is quietly one of the most influential people in America right now. That's my two cents.
Well, you know, he wears a humbleness about him, and his firm, the Daschle Group, and my firm, Scarlett, we do a lot of work together where they handle the federal lobbying, and we do a lot of the grass tops constituency building stuff. And it's always been a pleasure. I owe a lot to Nathan over the years. He hired me at DGA. We were fortunate enough post DGA to do some more entrepreneurial political things together. And then we've been working together, you know, in our two current hats ever since. But yeah, he's got a very unique relationship with then Governor Manchin, who we had three right in a row. Actually, it was four when I was the national political director at DGA, Nathan was the executive director, and our chairs right in a row were Kathleen Sebelius in Kansas, and then Joe Manchin in West Virginia, and then governor in Montana, Brian Schweitzer. And then after that, Governor O'Malley came in, and Colm and everybody else. And so, you know,
that's when all the winning ended.
No, actually, I think Colm would be happy to put his track record up against mine. We did a lot of great things there. We started the independent expenditure program at DGA, which was relatively new. They had been doing
it. Yeah, it's a fairly critical operation these days, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it had been done at the DSCC and DCCC, and actually, I was at DGA when another great Baltimore person was the political director at the DSCC, and that's Martha McKenna. And she was at DSCC, and I was at DGA, and we ran into the buzzsaw that was the 2010 elections for Democrats. So we were able to, federally, we really kind of took it on the chin, but we were able to save a couple of incumbents, not as many as we liked, and actually picked up a few races. And then I've been staying, affiliated with governor's races kind of independently here in Maryland, through my firm and through a lot of our mutual colleagues.
Talk about that a little, before I drag you down a perilous conversation about governors in Maryland, or the governor's race in Maryland. Just talk to us a little bit about what your firm does, what it's all about, who you work with, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, we founded the firm about 5 years ago. I had one client that either had the guts or was out of options and decided to come with me. From my previous firm, I worked at a large public affairs and crisis firm called Burson Marsteller in Washington, D.C. And I know you've worked with them.
We feel proud that many of our one of our KO alums is a big cheese there now. So, yeah.
Oh yeah,
Sloan Williams.
Yeah, that's right. I've heard actually. I was texting with Michael Fleischer over there. He's a big fan of Sloan, of course. And I worked with Michael, but I worked around the states helping trades and companies really build their verticals of support to help them achieve their federal, state, and sometimes market objectives. And so I kind of took that approach. I think that we all kind of see that while it is ever important to have a really robust government affairs operation in Washington, D.C., and it pays to have smart, connected, shrewd, really creative lobbyists like Nathan and so many of our other friends, that can't be your only strategy. And so kind of the premise of our entire firm is we engage constituencies at the state and local level to help support a federal and state government affairs approach by-
That's a pretty special niche, I think. I mean, I think that's a really smart niche. And I think particularly with Maryland, you're not just working on state stuff, you're working, the Maryland delegation is at the center of everything that's going on nationally. So it just seems like a really smart strategy, but it also seems like because there's a lot of space there, I feel.
Probably. There are, I think that, DC, much like Annapolis and many of these are our mutual friends, Damien, it was not short on lobbyists. And, I really kind of just started to see the value in our work when we would see our clients actually achieve, I think not solely because of the work that we would do, but, as part of a broader team. And so it gives me personally in the firm a lot of pride, as I know the KO team does as well, to be able to deliver for our clients. And so, we don't try to do too much. We don't do the federal lobbying. We don't do the state lobbying. We don't do, large, massive PR campaigns. We're not great at, doing kind of your standard corporate marketing. But this kind of one silo and niche, I think that we do a really good job. And we've had the benefit of working in 46 out of 50 states on federal, state, and local clients. A lot of work in the transportation infrastructure development space, a lot of energy work, a lot of renewable energy work. So it's been good. And we've, I we've kind of prided the firm on we know what we know and we don't know what we don't know, and let's stick to what we know. And then, you know, when we need to go partner with smart guys like yourself or Roshan or Nathan or anybody else, we kind of assembled our firm as a bullpen of sorts. So, you know, we have our core 9 or 10 people that are here through all of it. And then as a problem comes to us, we like to add in pieces to help our clients achieve solutions. Sometimes that's just with our folks here. Sometimes it's with our network on the ground. And sometimes we pull in experienced professionals like yourself.
I think that that's the best part of the job is the humility as strategy, because it enables you to build your coalition from the outset in such a way that sort of traces, you know, the experience that you're going to face on a broader macro level. So I love building those teams. And I think you putting yourself out there the way you do is not only smart, but really useful to a whole handful of different professionals. You know, I mean, your practice is very useful for people operating in Maryland, but it's critical for people all over the country that want to touch some of the most important voices in Washington. So I'm totally pumped for you. Now, you guys did some research too. I felt like that was like the first encounter I had with you. And I thought that was really special too, because it seemed to have a digital bent to it that got out of the same old polling.
That's right.
Budgets, et cetera. I felt like you broke a mold there in Maryland. Talk to me about that.
You know, we set up a 501c4 called Our Voice Maryland that was very active in the 2018 races, helping do some issue research and bring some issues to light mainly in some of the county executive races, including the Anne Arundel race, the Baltimore County race and the Howard County race, which all, you know, as you well know, about the new county executives. But
that's the whole ballgame, man, right there.
It is right there. I mean, you know, if you got those three areas, you're doing something right. And that very dynamic young leaders that I expect a lot from over the course of the years. But we realized after the election cycle was over that we really had something. And so, you know, we work with a digital polling firm that essentially kind of recreates the political electorate in any geopolitical area to recreate what the voting block might be for that exact time in that exact area. So they're constantly, you know, scraping things like Facebook and social media outlets and other marketing outlets to make sure that we have a very acute and accurate sample. And the reason that I think it is somewhat revolutionary is because it really cuts the cost in a sixth or a seventh. And so we're able to field reliable, you know, 600-800 person general public polls for about, you know, $6,000-$7,000, which, as you know, having worked with a lot of our friends in the polling industry, you know, they've done great work, and many of them, my friends and my colleagues, we use them on certain things. But at some point, there's a barrier to being able to work with them on and off.
Let's talk about this for a second, because this is fascinating to me. So you're telling me for the cost of $30,000, I might be able to get 3 or 4 looks at a constituency or an electorate, let's say in Maryland. I might be able to say to my client, hey, if we invest $35,000 or $40,000, we might get, you know, 3 or 4 looks at one electorate over several parts in time versus, you know, one benchmark survey for 40 grand or something like that.
Sure. That's precisely
my overstate.
No,
that's an incredible value add. And think about that. If you're a professional that's leading a major, you know, real estate trade association or healthcare trade association, that is that budget you just gave me, that 40, let's say 40 grand, get several looks. That's the cost of half of one of their lobbyists. And some of these major organizations may have, you know, 3, 4, 5 lobbyists. It just seems like an enormous value to be able to get that many looks at an electorate.
Oh, without a doubt.
Provide that data, you know, provide that data to elected officials, provide that data to, you know, obviously your corporate team, you know, just for your labor team, as the case may be. So, yeah. Thanks for bringing that to the market. I think that's something we got to talk about a lot.
Absolutely.
It just makes everybody smarter, man. It makes us all smarter.
It does. And as you well know, data, you know, just kind of in a vacuum is one thing. It's always interesting for a company or a trade or, you know, political professionals, public affairs professionals like ourselves to have a snapshot in time. But that information becomes so much more valuable when you're measuring it against the calendar to watch the progression or regression of
thank you for putting that so concisely.
That's been something, it was born out of some of our political clients that we worked with in 2018. And if I was, you know, smarter, I would have realized the value that it had on the issue side. And it's something that we do for a lot of our clients here in Maryland, throughout the Mid-Atlantic. And, you know, being able to go and kind of see the trajectory of public opinion in one area on one issue or something like that, makes us smarter and helps us deliver for our clients a little bit more when we're kind of reading through the data. So yeah, it's something that we put a lot of value on at Scarlet Oak and do for a lot of our clients.
Well, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but I do, and I'm not going to try to pin you down on this governor's race in Maryland, unless you want to be pinned down. But what I'm more interested in is you have a much different view of this race than I think a lot of us knuckleheads do. And it's not only because you lived it personally, but again, you have this broader perspective outside of Maryland. What can you tell us about this governor's race that maybe we're not hearing enough of?
Well, right now, just to be totally clear, I'm unaffiliated. I have, you know, some personal likes of some of the candidates running on the Democratic side. The first and most obvious thing that I see that is, you know, kind of glaring, and it doesn't take a long tenured political professional to point it out, is I'm just surprised that there's still not a woman in this race on the Democratic side, you know, and it's certainly not for lack of political talent among our female.
Is Martha McKenna going to fix that for us, or are you hearing anything?
I feel bad that I'm the one out there lobbying, you know, it's some subset every other day, 6 to 10 consultants, elected officials saying, get in the race. What are we doing? You know, I know that we have a very qualified woman running for statewide office in the controller out of Baltimore. And that's exciting. But, you know, as a Democrat, this is the state of Maryland. This is a Democratic primary. And it's going to be 2022. And to see the 8, 9, 10, whatever we're at, you know, candidates out there, you know, it's I'm still hopeful, if not confident, that maybe somebody decides to jump in here over the course of the summer as this race thins out. But I'd say a couple of things just outside of that from, you know, an observer's perspective. Number one, Republicans, they got their stuff together, you know. And I mean, you looked at this even three months ago and you had Boyd Rutherford and maybe Michael Steele and obviously Kelly Schultz and Barry Glassman. And you're kind of wondering how this was all going to shake out. And you know, frankly, Republicans in this state, even at the gubernatorial level, they need to throw a bit closer to a perfect game to win. They obviously still win and they have the last couple of times, but their margin for error is a little bit tighter than I think it is for Democrats, just based on voter registration and the bent of the state. That being said, you know, the Republicans, and this is more true historically, I think, both nationally and they surely have done this cycle. They have some strong candidates without primaries right now, without serious primaries right now, running for, you know, the top offices in the state. And so being a Democrat, I'm a little bit worried right now. And if looking at everything, I'd probably rather be, you know, a Kelly Schultz operative sitting at this point in mid-July in 2021 than anybody else.
You like that 62% right direction number in the state of Maryland if you're Kelly Schultz?
I mean, why would you not, right? And if you can say, I mean, I think that we all organically know right now that generally people are feeling pretty bearish in the country. You know, I think that there was some optimism with the new administration. There's certainly optimism coming on the heels of vaccinations and breakthroughs, and we're hoping that the economy is going in the right direction. But at best, I think people were still a little bit skittish out there. And so when you can post up a number like that and you can say you had a meaningful role for her, you know, in this administration, I think she's going to be tough. And I just hear anecdotally, and I'm sure you do too, in the bar rooms of Annapolis, which, you know, I've been known to frequent. You know, even when I talk to my Democratic lobbyist friends and people around here, I hear her name a lot. So I'm hopeful that we can straighten some things out here on our side. This is going to be the most expensive Democratic primary in a cumulative rate, I think, ever in this state when you look back.
What do you think the most competitive people are going to have to bring to the table?
I think if you're going to win it, let's just say, you know, 80% of the current candidates stay in, you know, all the way until June of next year, I think that you're going to have to be a lot closer to Anthony's number, which I think was 11 or 12 million raised in that 2014 primary, than what Rushern or Ben had back in 2018, which I think was like between 4 and 6 for each of them. So, you know, if you're looking at this, if you're a Tom Perez, that's great. You have a national fundraising profile that you can tap into. You know, same thing if you're Wes Moore, and you know, there's certain, Peter Francio has been elected here for statewide for a long time and has been in it. But like, it's going to be hard to have, so let's just say, even 5 people all raise between $8 and $10 million to stay the mayor, because you're looking at just 50 then among them, and we haven't even gotten anywhere yet. So I think. One other just observation.
There's only 2 ways out of that. Have your own podcast and declare yourself neutral, or get picked up by one of the campaigns so you don't have to pay 8 or 9 ways, right?
You're absolutely right on that. I'm staying with you, David. That's the only thing that I'll say. But I will say,
hey, I might have to do both.
That's right. I will say, you know, I think it's going to be interesting given where we are, just on the heels of COVID with the electorate. You know, last year, I think you heard this from so many elected officials in the state. It's just difficult to communicate and connect with voters. You know, there's Zoom fatigue. There's only so much you can do with all of it. You know, people, I think, want to be out there meeting candidates. Candidates want to be out there meeting voters, meeting activists, building their small donor profile, you know, database, you know, being able to recruit people that are ultimately going to be the volunteers and the spine of these campaigns. So, I candidly don't know. Are people eager to get back to the, you know, the clam bakes and the crab feast and the when you got to go to Washington County on a Wednesday night for a local Democratic club dinner or something like that? That's grueling retail politics, and it's still meaningful in a state.
Let me ask you about that. I agree with that. I get the quandary there, but everybody gets mad when I'm impressed with something Peter Francio does. So everybody be prepared to get upset that I'm going to be impressed by something Peter Francio does. But I told Jeff Barker from The Sun about this too. It's like, there used to be like, you know, you go do your Eastern Shore swing and you meet with key elites and you meet with younger organizers and donors and you do the whole thing. Now, you know, you can go on to like the Scrapple trail and cut a minute video of yourself relating to, you know, Clay Mitchell's a gang of, you know, 5,000, 10,000 Facebook fans. And you can, it seems to me that you can connect in a similar sort of way.
I still think it matters.
And you can do it with so much broader, right? I don't know. I'd be interested.
I still think it matters. You know, I think even though you have the Washington, D.C. media market here, which is expensive, and, you know, Baltimore, which is obviously a critical market. This is not California or Texas, where you got to get known in 26 different markets, and it's outrageously expensive to get known in each of these markets. I still hear, I was at MML, you know, a few weeks ago, and I met.
Yeah, how was that?
It was fantastic, you know, and to go see my friends. Most people, I would imagine listening to your pod, know that Maryland has an incredibly strong, always has batch of mayors from every part of this state, and that mayoral network, both Democrats and Republicans, whether it's Western Maryland, Southern Maryland, Central Maryland, Eastern Maryland, wherever, is a very tight-knit, integrated, batch of political
and diverse, folks. I bet, more diverse than
and very diverse. Yep, yep. And they all talk. And when I was down there, I met with, you know, 8 or 10 of them individually when I was down there, just to kind of catch up on political things. And they all told me who was there and who was there and came in and do their speech, but then left right away without doing the 8 or 12 hours of handshakes and coffees and all that. And I heard which ones did do all that. And so I think, you know, I think that you can leapfrog to some extent the way that politics was done in Maryland, you know, throughout the 20th century by some of these new innovative technologies? I do, but I don't think that you can just totally neglect the retail politics of old. And I think, frankly, one of the reasons that Larry Hogan has been so popular over the years is because he is somebody who knows that, intimately, and adopted that philosophy, not just on the stump, you know, for each of his races, but also as governor. We see him around the state. He's out there.
I remember him in running against Anthony Brown with the bus. You know, I remember him at the Towson Parade.
Right.
Comfortable in that thing. I was like, man, this guy's a phenomenon.
He knows it. So
he did what you've been trying to tell people forever, which is, hey, you got to have another organization out there. His is called Change Maryland, but you got to have some other sort of message oriented organization that can do your communication and not bog you down in the back and forth. I'd like to know your point of view on this. If you're at 60% right direction, I think that number's right, 60%+ right direction in Maryland. Let's say that holds and you got a Democratic candidate and a Republican candidate. I just think that is very risky. And it seems to me to be so politically immature for the states, for leaders in the Democratic Party not to organize some sort of counter messaging to the Hogan experience and use these last 2 months or 2 years of his tenure to really talk the truth about him. And to me, if we can't even pull that together, why are we going to drive everybody else bonkers about getting in on the, you know, for a particular candidate when we can't even coalesce to sort of not pull this guy down a couple pegs to make it a fair race for everybody? I know you can say that much more succinctly.
I was someone when we were at DGA, we knew we had a tough cycle in 2010. And we sat down very early, Nathan and I, and some of the governors, and you know, Governor O'Malley was kind of part of that executive board back then, and said, look, we got to be swinging, and we got to be swinging early to lay a glove on not just these incumbent Republican governors, but you know, some of these ones that are working their way through the primary that we think are more problematic from a general election sense. We spent so much money in 2009 and even the first half of 2010 just mucking up a lot of these Republican candidates just to, you know, get a glove on them. I mean, I think, look, when you look at this, it's particularly from the national perspective, you got to be pugilistic, but you got to fight all 12 rounds. And these the rounds are happening, you know, right now, even though we're entirely focused on the primary. And so not that I'd be advocating for an independent expenditure or anything like that in the state of Maryland from the DGA and others.
Hey, if Trippi and Schmidt can do it on their podcast, certainly we can talk about that reality here, right? I mean, it's just like to me, it's like, you want me to get involved in all this other stuff, but you don't want to address that? Like, what are we doing here?
If the governor stays, you know, at mid-60s and the right track, wrong track on state stays, you know, 60+ or something like this, I get news for you on the primary. It doesn't really matter if it's West or if it's Peter. I mean, it's not going to look good. And it's going to be a very difficult argument for any of them to make, and frankly, us even as kind of activists. And if I, you know, the part of it too is some of the down ticket stuff. You know, you look at, we're obviously very focused on the governor's race, but there's going to be there's an open rate county executive race in Frederick County. There's going to be a very competitive race here in Anne Arundel County. I look at, like, you know, some of the candidates, like my friend Katie Fry-Hester over in Howard County, who won in the ninth in 2018 for the first time in 20 years. You know, I'm a big fan of Katie's, but I'm a little bit worried if she's got to run in that district with so much Carroll County in it with a governor that's got, you know, 63, 64. So I'm not just looking at the governor's race, even though we do have so much of a Democratic majority here in the state, but I'm worried about some of the down ticket implications that exist if we don't do exactly what you're advocating for, which is get nasty quickly.
Yeah, it's just the record's so clear. I mean, we don't even need to get nasty. You just need to tell the truth.
That's right.
I find it beguiling. I have a theory about this, and I want to test it by you. Yeah, nobody likes this theory. It's fairly benign, but nobody likes it, which is the reason we can't get people focused on these governor's races. And again, your father was won in the last millennium. And overcame all odds to do it. Martin O'Malley has been the only person in this millennia to be able to win the governorship for Democrats. And I just feel like, is it because we are so blessed with an incredibly high-ranking federal delegation and that we don't have term limits in the state legislature or at the federal level, and the power in Maryland, whether it was the two mics or now it's we have a whole new fresh dynamic, but the power seems to rest very much in Annapolis with the legislature and very much in Washington with the federal delegation. And the governor's race just kind of seems to be less of a priority with all those actors to me. I mean, is it sort of a structural power dynamic that leaves so much emptiness on the Democratic side?
And I do think part of that is yeah, I mean, to your point, I do
think. I mean, can you imagine a world without Yvette Lewis? Like, with Yvette Lewis or Kathleen Matthews isn't our party chair. I mean, it's like, we would have nothing. We have absolutely nothing when it comes to governor's race.
I mean, you're absolutely
right. They're very sensitive to it. They appreciate it, but they don't get much help.
I think you're absolutely right. I do think that there is such a focus both on DC and then, you know, everything that transpires here in Annapolis. You know, it's unique. I think even the average voter is more informed on federal issues, particularly in the DC side of the market, Prince George's, Montgomery, you know, where they're constantly seeing all the news kind of come out of Washington, DC. So I do think there's kind of an over-allotment and, you know, too much of a focus on the federal piece, and it does kind of get away from us. And you know, you mentioned this at the very top of it. We've been very lucky here in terms of federal delegation to have people like Leader Hoyer, who I was on a fundraiser with, you know, yesterday, and you know, so many other, I think, dynamic members of our, in particular, our House delegation, like Congressman Raskin, Congressman Brown, Congressman Sarbanes, people like that. But I do think that, you know.
Yeah, but the Speaker of the House, when the Capitol is being mobbed by a bunch of insurrectionists, she can't call into her home state to get help. She's got to call the governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia to bail her out. Like, what an embarrassment that is. That's the difference between having a Democratic governor and a Republican. Yeah,
I do think, though, that there's been something, you know, it's almost like kind of waving a flag among the Democratic establishment, you know, here almost to D.C. saying, well, don't forget about the governor's race here. You know, I just think that everybody is just so focused on the federal stuff. And, you know, you go talk to a well-networked, wealthy donor in Montgomery County, and he or she might be more likely to give to a contested House race to protect Susan Wilde's House seat in Pennsylvania than they might do here, because they're looking at, you know, everything that happens in the House January 6th. You know, they're looking at all these big issues where we got to kind of set ourselves on fire and run around just to be able to get anybody to pay attention to it. So that's why I'm always appreciative of, you know, I know you're a gubernatorial race evangelist, as am I, and I always tell some, you know, particularly going into redistricting and everything, you know, you see how important it is when we're seeing these both federal and state maps chopped up again. We see everything that's happening, many of these Republican governors, particularly those in the South, and we just see the absolutely asinine, you know, voting right and infringements that they're kind of trying to shove through in places like Georgia and Texas and everything like that. Governors matter. You know, going back to the very front of our conversation, it's why I've been so attracted to it, is because they have, you know, infinitely more power to affect policy in any given state in any given time. Then I think most people would give it credit for or understand. And I've always been a fan of those races. And I want, if anybody walks away from this podcast taking anything, it doesn't matter what horse you pick, get your horse. And then let's focus some time trying to focus on Republicans here for the next, you know, year until this primary goes, or else it's going to be a big problem for us.
I got a special question for you. It's a bit of a doozy, so be patient with me. But I had a chance to spend some time on the phone with Will O'Malley, Governor O'Malley's son, who's headed to law school, I believe. And I got to hang out with his 18-year-old kid, Jack, you know, and just two incredible young men, brilliant sisters that are both achieving. I just wondered if you could give, you're probably too humble to try to give any advice, but any reflection you have on, you know, being this, you know, growing up in Government House and then somehow keeping your act all together up through your professional life and just, you know, being an incredible dynamic person, just sort of any advice you would have for those guys that are about to go through that, that walk of life that you've had, or
you know, first of all, to your first point, you know, I know Will, and I couldn't be more impressed as well as him do, you know, great things in his life, which is not surprising given his parents. You know, it's great to see someone like that. That's got his head so squarely, you know, tied on. I'm not sure I always did, but I appreciate the, you know, the compliment. I was very lucky, and I feel incredibly, I guess you could say, unique among many statewide elected officials' sons or daughters, in that, you know, my father, you know, he grew up pretty humble in the state of Florida and kind of brought himself up through the ranks and got himself a scholarship to Broward County Community College in Southern Florida, and then got himself a scholarship to FSU from there, and then got himself a scholarship to grad school and got his doctorate at 23 and came here teaching at Maryland, worked his way through Hyattsville City Council and the County Council and being executive of Prince County, went 19-0, if you can believe it, if you add up primary and general elections.
I believe it, man, a professor.
And nobody accused him of having, you know, the most organic oratorical skills in the history of the world, but he understood politics and he understood people, and he really, really.
And all you got to understand is about him. I just cut you off talking about your dad. I'm so sorry, but he. All you got to know about that guy is he brought the Ravens to Baltimore. You know, he knew what our spirit was, and he found it. And you know, people said he was, you know, didn't connect, man. Like, I connect with him every Sunday because of that.
Oh, he's, and
sorry to take you off track there.
One of his most proud accomplishments is a season ticket holder to the Ravens as well. I don't let a Sunday go by in the fall where I don't thank him, but you know, he really kind of instilled in me at, you know, a young age and throughout my teenage years and early 20s, just that, you know, hard work really does matter. Personal relationships matter. Showing respect to people really matters. Knowing that you don't have it all figured out earlier in your life, and, you know, being able to learn from people that you value their opinion and have done good things in their life. He still is learning from people every single day. And he actually, you know, I know you're out west, Damon, but he actually joined our firm this morning as a senior advisor role. He's going to help with
fantastic.
Some of our infrastructure clients. Yes. So
now, as a communications guy, can I counsel you to put that at the front of the conversation, or is that on me? I'm sorry.
There's a reason when we need like real PR reputational help, you're the first guy I call, because, you know, I think you have it down a little bit better than I do. He's on now, and we're just thrilled about it.
That's huge.
It really, It's fantastic to be able to work with your father, somebody that I just personally admire and like so much, but also being able to tap his mind, both in terms of the policy, but also the political process, the policy process. He's obviously so smart when it comes to things like, you know, energy, the environment, infrastructure, transportation, things like that. So he'll be a great
actor. Look, he's a very loyal dude too. Let me tell you why I know this. Okay. Let me tell you why I know this. Cause Ken Allman, who was working for him, Sam Moxley, who was the Baltimore County Council in my native lands there, and then the chairman of the city senators, Nathaniel McFadden, all sort of encouraged me to be a student member of the Board of Regents. And as I said, I went to University of Delaware for undergraduate and the student politics there, but then I went to University of Baltimore for law school, and you can qualify as a law student to be on the Regents, right? Because from any of those universities at any level. And so Ken Allman comes back with a forlorn look in his face, and he says to me, he goes, "Governor's not going for it, man." And I was like, "Oh man, that's a bummer." And then he explains it to Sam Moxley and McFadden. He goes, "The governor said there's no way in hell I'm putting a University of Delaware blue head student body president on the University of Maryland Board of Regents. The hell will freeze over before I ever do that." So, I mean, I just love the intensity over a student member appointment. You know, he believes in that stuff, man. And he ultimately put me on, you'll love this, he ultimately put me on the Maryland Higher Education Commission as a student member. It was a little more agreeable to have the University of Baltimore law student and Delaware guy in that role. And you know who was on that commission with me, in addition to the wonderful Pat Florestano, was our Secretary of Higher Education. And that tells you all you need to know about Paris Glendening, is that lady was in charge of higher ed. But Terry Learman was on the board with me, and I, you know, had a 20 some odd year friendship with Terry as a result of being on that in 1998. So just can't thank your family enough for, and I think that made me a Democrat for life. So
I think that's right. He never forget, you know, it's funny. He and I have talked, and, you know, if I asked him what he had for lunch yesterday, and myself included in that, I probably couldn't remember, but you say, "Hey, you know, I ran into so-and-so and he told me about me, you know, meeting you at the Taws Clam Bake in 84. He'd be like, "Oh, who was there?" It was Mickey Steinberg on the left, and it was me, and it was so-and-so. And I'll just tell you the exact trapdoor. And, you know, it's just, it's fun to be able to hear all the anecdotes after all these years. And he still remembers them like yesterday. And then, you know, that team, you mentioned Ken Allman is, you know, a good friend of mine, and we do some work together, but there were so many people, and I don't even want to try to get into naming him, but some Karen White.
Well, Karen White, yeah. Well, you can name him, but just in that Secretary of State's office, I tried to get a job in there. John Willis asked me, he's like, "Well, how do you come up with your political ideations?" And I was like, "I like to talk to people in bars." You know, I didn't think that worked out too well, but they had Sushant. They had Amy Tate. They had Len Foxwell, Ken Allman, all in that Secretary of State's office, man. That's like,
ooh. Yeah, absolutely. John Picari was a
big John part Picari, of
that.
Yeah.
Will Castleberry is a big part of that. I mean, there were Joe Bryce was there. I mean, you name it. It was an all-star.
Will Castleberry, the director of the finance of the Glendening alumni. We all want to be that guy.
That's right. I learned a lot from my dad, but I also learned a lot from them. One of my first things that I used to do is I would ride around sometimes with either Sushant or Will or Ken, or sometimes all of them, to go do, you know, real basic campaign things back in 94, including set up the announcement at the University of Maryland College Park back in 94. And this is when,
you know, how old were you then?
I was a freshman in high school.
Wow.
In 94. So I learned from those guys who were kind of coming up through the ranks as political operatives. And I still talk to many of them on a very regular basis. And I learned as much from them about Maryland and politics, but also the right way to do things, as I did from my family. So I consider myself very lucky and always try to stay, you know, learning and talking to people and hearing the anecdotes, because it's been an important part of my life.
Congratulations to you and your dad and Brian, the whole team over there. That's fantastic news. And send us something so we can put that up on Center Maryland some way, somehow. If you guys put a video together or, you know, a little written thing, whatever we can do. I'd love to push that out there. And then everybody else on this call, I think, learned a lot about how you can offer a lot of fresh perspective to labor unions, corporations, family offices, all facing a Maryland landscape that is very dynamic. And I think you explained a number of different ways that you add a ton of value to the team. So I'm excited to pull you into more stuff myself. And I know, appreciate you always looking out for KO whenever you can as well. Can't thank you enough.
Yeah, no, it's great to see you. Love working with you. Love the podcast. Been listening to it all summer long as I walk my dog on the hot summer nights.
Me and Revolutions are on the same thing. I am honored.
Yeah, I know.
I think that's one of my most informative political podcasts, is listening to Revolutions these days, right? So I learned it. My first lesson with the Revolution was when Martin O'Malley and our team ran up against Bernie Sanders. We learned the Revolution the hard way that time.
Oh, man. This is fun.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate it.